Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 9, Side 1. The smoke was clearing away up there. The enormous wreck had not moved, but a channel had been cut through the upper and lower crater edges. A trickle of water started through the farther one. Just a trickle? Johnny held his breath, eyeing it with a scope, afraid that, in their shortness of time, they would have to shoot again. "Come on, come on," he was saying. "More, more." He knew water was very erosive and tended to chew and widen its own way. "Come on." The farther side was at least 2 feet higher than the lake at the dam. It should have more push than that. Right then, some object in the way of the flow was worked out by the water. It was a big blast gun. It twisted in the swirl and then at last went tumbling away. The water burst through the far crater wall. It swirled and surged in the crater, a boiling, frothing churn of discolored mud. Water thrust the upper channel wider. More water burst through. Now it was working at the nearest ditch the blast cord had dug. It gnawed at obstruction and debris. And then it started through. A third surge in the upper crater. Pieces were tearing loose. There was a roaring torrent there now. The bowl was filling. It was emptying into the lower lake. They had gotten the river running again. Johnny told Dwight to give them a very well done. The drills were raving and smoking. Johnny looked at his watch. They only had about 20 minutes left. Where had the time gone? "How many drill sections have you gotten into those holes?" asked Johnny to Thor. 5. That's 75 feet. It will have to be enough. Get those drills out of there. Storm along," he barked into his radio. "Start pulling these crews and equipment out of here." He could see Chief Chong Wan, a speck way over on the far side. He spoke into his mind radio. "Chief, you are going to see one awful flash over here in a few minutes. Wait to make sure the whole dam doesn't go out, and the instant it's safe, send a picked crew in there to open 2 generator ports and get the power back on to the cone cable and pagoda area only. Got it?"
"Yes, Lord Johnny."
"And be sure to be under cover for this blast," added Johnny. They had the portapacks out and were clattering them in plain holds. "Dwight," said Johnny, "take those 3 drums of liquid explosive and pour them in those holes, and then set the empty drums on top of them, fast." Dwight pointed with his good arm and got men running. They began to pour a big drum of explosive into each hole. The holes were still so hot, the explosive was almost boiling. It was hard to get it to flow down against the trapped air. The air came bubbling and steaming back up. Johnny raced along, stringing blast cord. He put a big loop of it around each place where they would set a drum. The drums would be like bombs with the explosive vapor still in them.
"Fuses!" yelled Dwight.
"We've got no time," shouted Johnny. "I'm going to set this off with the plane's guns."
"What?"
gawked Thor. They had the barrels empty and were putting them in place in the circle of blast cord at each hole. A shot into any one drum would set off the lot. "Leave me that plane," Johnny pointed at a single battle plane they'd brought. "Get the rest of them out of here with all men right now." Stormalong started to protest and then started hurrying men into the remaining ships. As their equipment went slamming into the planes, Stormalong yelled over to Johnny,
"Shoot it from way up! This thing is going to skyrocket!"
Johnny was looking at his watch. They only had 9 minutes left. The planes were taking off. Dwight was being dragged into the last one. Johnny looked at this setup. All okay. He rushed to the battle plane and got ready to start it. There was nobody left in the area. He took off. He jumped the ship to about 2,000 feet. The dam still looked big. The planes were landing in sandbag abutments on the other side. Stormalong had really gotten across and slammed them down in an awful hurry. Chief Chong Wan and his men were under cover.
"Fire in the hole," said Johnny on his mind radio.
He flipped the guns to flame, narrow, and maximum. He checked his security belt. Now for some nice gunnery. At this moment, it all looked pretty peaceful down there. The blackened wreck was spilling flotsam as water went through its broken girders. The river was flowing right up to the dam lake. But the increased water was spilling under the dam below the lake, and it would be tearing that hole wider and wider. Johnny closed all windows with a flick of switches, made sure all doors were secure. Should he back up to 3,000? No. This was the best range. A battle plane could take a lot. But he had never heard of anybody setting off 150 gallons of liquid explosive before, plus 1,000 feet of number 5 blast cord. He put his sights carefully on the center barrel. He pushed the gun trip. There was a flash across the whole sky before him, a curtain of green fire 3,000 feet high. Crash! The recoil hit him, and the plane went spinning skyward like a thrown toy. The yank of the security belt was like a blow. It knocked the wind out of him. 3 seconds later, he found he was upside down. He punched the console. The plane's balance motors caught up and righted it. He was flying backward. The whine of engines fought against the wrong direction. The plane steadied. Somebody would have to replace the windscreen. It had a diagonal crack in it. And then he saw the cliff. The smoke had cleared, and the whole cliff front was sliding down toward the lake in slow, slow motion. 500,000 cubic yards of rock moving down. A lot of it was apparently still in one piece, but that was an illusion. It was a clean slice of cliff, knifed off neatly. But inside it, the rock was cracked and shattered, and just before it hit the water, it lost shape and tumbled into fragments. It had looked at first like it hadn't left the bank, but there had been distance. Some of it struck nearly at the center of the lake. He watched the dam. Would it, too, crumble in slow motion, and this whole lake go roaring down the gorge? He had set it up so the shock wave would go into the air, not down through the ground. It had gone into the air, all right. Witness what happened to his plane. The first wave hit the dam, and a splatter of water soared 100 feet above the dam top. Had he lost too much water there? No, that was just spray. Was the dam holding? He could not tell whether the underwater currents were carrying the rock into the low hole. He darted the plane sideways. Water was still roaring out under the dam. He watched. Was it his imagination that it was lessening? His attention was yanked off it by blue figures racing down to the powerhouse. They certainly had not waited. He looked at his watch. He had only 2 minutes to get this plane out of the air. With a pound on the console keys, Johnny lanced the plane down to an empty abutment. He killed its motor. He had to make sure it was off. His ears were ringing. 33 seconds left to go. That was cutting it close. He went through the underground passage into the cone. He looked at the pagoda. Not even a tile had moved in that blast. Angus was at the console. The small gray man at the computer. Angus waved and shouted.
Power's on! We're firing!
4. Somebody else had been busy in the last 2 hours. A different music was playing. It was very noble and dignified. It sounded vaguely familiar to Johnny, and then he remembered that a cadet had found a pile of what he called records, big things. If you ran a rose thorn, held in a paper box around an endless circular groove, and put your ear close, it sounded like 20 or 30 instruments playing. The ancient label on the record, mostly faded out, said the name of the piece was the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra, Lohengrin. This music was much like that, but deeper, fuller, quite impressive. Johnny suspected the small gray man had had a hand in that. Something from his ship? Music for the delegates to arrive by, of course. And something else that must be from the small gray man's ship. There was a screen, meshed so you could see through it, all around the firing platform, and Dr. Allen was finishing putting it up. "Disease control," he said cryptically as Johnny passed by. Sweaty Chinese engineers crawled out of a duct hole with cheery faces. They had air circulating in and out now. The smoke had already cleared away. A good thing, thought Johnny. A lot of different atmospheres would momentarily be whiffing across the platform at the instant of coincidence of spaces and during recoil especially. And the mobs of Chinese refugees from the village had changed, too. They may have lost their village, but they had saved their possessions, and these had been scattered about. Now the untidy bundles had vanished. Children and dogs were quiet down in the rifle pits, and parents and others that had no immediate duties were standing about. They had on what must be their best clothes. An honor guard came out of a bunker and finished neatening themselves up with a tug here and a buckle there. Six of them, different nationalities, all in their best uniforms. No weapons but the shafts of pennons. An aged Chinese gentleman, no, a Buddhist communicator dressed to look like a Chinese, wearing a silk robe with designs on it and a small cap, was taking position at the head of the honor guard. Of course, somebody who spoke Cyclo to greet the arrivals, yet who looked like a dignitary. It would be 3 or 4 minutes until the first one appeared, and Johnny walked toward the ops room. He didn't get in. The boy, Kwong, sprinted out, going somewhere fast, and Sir Robert popped out of the door and called after him. "And tell Storm along to bring the other recognition book, too." The boy hardly checked his pace, nodding in full run. Beyond Sir Robert, the ops room was boiling with sound and movement as people worked. Johnny opened his mouth to ask how it was going, but Sir Robert answered before he could speak. Sir Robert shook his head bleakly. "They're using a new kind of bomb. The guns sometimes don't explode it, and the idiots are burning deserted cities. Our drones are still running. Why would they want to burn an empty place that used to be called San Francisco? The last drone shot we had of it, there were just 2 bears walking down the street. We're dealing with daft imbeciles." Johnny made to go in past him, and Sir Robert shook his head again. "You can't do anything more than we're doing. Have you thought what we're going to tell these emissaries?" "No idea," said Johnny. "Shouldn't we get Clan Chief Fergus down here?"
"No, no," said Sir Robert. "No, in a wee chance. Edinburgh is gang up in flames."
Johnny felt a contraction of his heart.
"Any news of Chrissy?"
"They'd all be doon in the shelters. Donald Dean has given them all the air cover he can."
Stormalong raced in with the book. Sir Robert took a look at Johnny.
"Go get yourself cleaned up, and think of something to tell these arrivals."
He shooed Johnny off toward his room and vanished into ops. He closed the door behind him so the frantic sounds wouldn't come into the platform area. Johnny walked on toward his room. Just as he was about to duck into the passage, the humming of the wires, which had been going on underneath the music, made itself known by stopping. There was a space of time and then a slight recoil. The Hockner emissary was on the platform. Noseless, holding a monocle on a stick, he was dressed in shimmering robes. He had a gold-colored hamper beside him. A bell on the screen pinged. The screen top edge lit with a purple glow all around. The Hockner picked up the hamper, looked about through his monocle, and minced off the platform. The honor guard saluted and dipped pennons. He halted well clear of the disease control fence. A messenger took the hamper from him. The Buddhist in Chinese clothes bowed. In a supercilious tone of voice, the Hockner emissary said in Cyclo,
"I am Blanjetso, extraordinary minister plenipotentiary of the Emperor of the Hockners. Long may he reign. I am empowered to negotiate and arrange final and binding amendments to agreements or treaties in all things political or military. My person is inviolate, and any molestation cancels any agreements. Any effort to hold me hostage shall be in vain, for I shall not be redeemed by my government. At the threat of any torture or extortion, you are warned that I shall commit suicide instantly in ways unknown to you. I am not the carrier of any disease nor weapon. Long live the Hochner Empire. And how are you today? The communicator, dressed as a Chinese, bowed and made a brief, fast speech of welcome, very pat, told him the conference would begin in about 3 hours, and led him off to a private apartment where he could rest or refresh himself. Johnny had an idea these arrivals would all be about the same, different only as to races, persons, and clothes. He was trying to think of something to tell the emissaries. It was a bit of a shock for Sir Robert to infer that it was up to him, when that grizzled old veteran didn't have any ideas. But then, he must be terribly distressed over Edinburgh. So was Johnny. 5. Johnny ducked under the door beam to enter the passage to his room, and a wave of dizziness hit him. So far, in trying to handle the dam, he had carried himself along on willpower, and he had pushed the feeling aside. But now, with worry about Edinburgh and Chrissy, he felt he was not in very good condition to handle much of anything. He had taken quite a battering these last couple of days. He was not prepared for what he found in the passage just outside his room. There were 4 people there, and they were working on things he couldn't quite make out. They had low benches, they were sitting on the floor, their heads were down, and their hands were flying. Mr. Tsung sensed his presence and bobbed up from the floor. He bowed.
Lord Johnny, meet my wife.
The second person, a gray-haired Chinese woman with a kindly face, bobbed up, smiled, bowed. Johnny bowed. It made his head feel bad. The woman popped down and went right back to work.
Meet my daughter, said Mr. Tsung.
The third person bobbed up, bowed. The daughter was a very beautiful Chinese girl, very delicate. She wore a flower in her hair. Johnny bowed. It made his head feel worse. The girl sat down and went frantically back to work.
Meet my son-in-law, said Mr. Tsung.
A good-looking Chinese bobbed up from his bench with a clatter. He bowed. He was in the blue work uniform the mechanics wore. Johnny bowed very slightly so the room wouldn't spin. The young man popped down, and sparks again flew from his tools. Johnny looked at them. They were working dedicatedly and with near ferocity on whatever they were doing. Johnny felt a pang of sorrow. If this conference failed, and if they lost, what suffering would await these decent people? These and the rest of the 35,000 that were all that remained of the human race. He could not face the prospect of letting them down. He went into his room. Somebody else had used those 2 hours. Angus, probably, and an electrician. A rack with 3 view screens now stood against the wall beyond the foot of his bed. A button camera had been placed in the ops room for 1 screen, and he could see the huddled groups there, faces strained as they handled microphones and drone pictures and the operations board. Another button camera was trained on the conference room to broadcast to the 2nd screen. The conference room was empty. The 3rd button camera was on the platform and console and served the 3rd screen. Even as he looked, the Tallnep emissary arrived. He was in shimmering green. Even his cap was green. But he had on dirty blue boots. Huge glasses hid his eyes. He carried a sort of scepter with a large knob at the top and a green hamper on green wheels for his food and supplies. A reptilian creature, although he walked upright and had a face and arms and legs. A genetic line from dinosaurs that had become miniature and sentient. He made his speech much like the Hochner, accepted the reply with an evil smile, folded his shimmering green cloak about his steel-hard body, and was led away to a private apartment. He looked like trouble. Johnny was about to throw himself down on the bed when he suddenly obstructed. Mr. Tsung had followed him in.
No, no, said Mr. Tsung. Bath!
2 Chinese had followed Mr. Tsung in. They had a steaming bath sitting on a mine dolly, which they pushed to an empty spot on the floor before vanishing. I happened to be just about exhausted, said Johnny in protest. I will just wash my face. Mr. Tsung slid around in front of him with a mirror.
Look, demanded Mr. Tsung.
Johnny looked. Mud. Explosive stains. The black silk sling he had been wearing was a tatter of light tan. Silt was all through his beard and hair. He looked down and saw that somewhere he must have walked up to his waist in ooze. He looked down at his hands, and he could not even tell the color of his skin. He looked like something no dog would have dragged out of the village garbage dump. You win, said Johnny, and wearily began to get out of his clothes. Mr. Tsung had a big mine bucket, and as each garment was removed, he dropped it with some distaste in the bucket, even the helmet and boots and guns. Johnny climbed into the bath. It was not long enough to stretch out his legs, but the water came up to his chest. He had never had a hot bath before, only rivers and cold mountain streams. He felt the exhaustion oozing out of him. Indeed, he found with some surprise, there was much you could say in favor of hot baths. Avoiding the bandage on one arm, Mr. Tsung scrubbed industriously with a lathering soap and a brush. Suddenly, he stopped work, and there was a whispered consultation back of Johnny. Then a touch on the top of each of Johnny's shoulders. Another consultation, and one of Johnny's arms was held out by Mr. Tsung, and a piece of string was stretched down the length of it. Johnny was momentarily horrified to realize the daughter was behind him, and he was naked in the tub. He turned his head, but the daughter was gone. Mr. Tsung scrubbed on. He washed Johnny's hair and beard. Twice more the bath was stopped, once to put a string around his chest, the second time to put a string down the side of his leg. Eventually, Mr. Tsung dried his hair and beard with a towel and then wrapped a bigger one around Johnny as he stepped out of the tub. He dried Johnny off, having to jump up a bit to really get the shoulders now that Johnny was standing. He put Johnny in a soft blue robe and only then permitted him to lie down on the bed. Thankful to stretch out at last, avoiding even looking at the screens, Johnny was interrupted again. It was Dr. McKendrick and Dr. Allen. The robe was loose, and they got his arm out. Dr. Allen cut off the bandage, cleaned the area with alcohol that stung the nose, probably whiskey of not too good a distillation, poured some white powder in the wound, and then made him eat some of it. More sulfur. Mr. Tsung was there with a bowl of soup, while Dr. Allen put on a fresh bandage. Then the two doctors stood back. Johnny, wise in such medical manners, began to suspect they were up to something. They had that false joviality doctors assume just before they take you by surprise and do something gruesome. I always thought, said Dr. Allen, that Donald Dean and Stormalong were wild. But I was out there when you blew that cliff in. You are the wild one, Johnny Tyler. Do you always use a battle plane to light fuses? Johnny was about to inform him somewhat austerely that there had been no time at all to rig fuses when Dr. McKendrick moved closer. I suppose, said Dr. McKendrick, it just seemed more natural to him. A remark calculated to distract. And he took the long needle he had been holding behind him and, seizing Johnny's wrist, slid 2 inches of steel into a vein and pumped a full syringe of something into Johnny's blood. Ow! Said Johnny. That wasn't fair. You know I don't like your needles. The stuff burned like fire in his vein. That's for your dizziness, said Dr. McKendrick, smugly cleaning the needle. It's some stuff we found called B-complex. The venom and the relaxant and the sulfur all rob the system of it. You'll feel much better very shortly. I've got enough to do, said Johnny, a bit cross, without being shot full of holes. Dr. Allen laid a hand on his shoulder. That's just it, he said. You've got far, far too much to worry about and to do. You've got to learn to let others help you. Let them contribute as well. You do splendidly. Let others help, too. He gave Johnny a pat on the shoulder, and they left. The soup had made his stomach feel better. After a bit, he raised his head and bobbed it. He wasn't as dizzy as he had been. Another couple of emissaries had arrived on the platform. The ops room looked frantic. He was worried about this coming conference.
Johnny thought he had lain around long enough.
Tsung, he called. Please get out my best buckskin suit.
Yes, he would let someone else contribute. Mr. Tsung could dig up his buckskins. The result was totally unexpected. Mr. Tsung flashed in, drew himself up to his full 5 feet, and said,
No!
Then he struggled to find more words from his meager store of English.
They lords!
He couldn't say what he wanted to say. An amazed Johnny saw Mr. Tsung tear out of the room and come back in a moment with a coordinator for the Chinese, one who spoke Mandarin. Mr. Tsung was blazing away at the coordinator with every shot in his magazine. Mr. Tsung died down. The coordinator opened his mouth to speak. Mr. Tsung thought of something else, battered the coordinator with it, and only then stood back with a "so there" expression and put his hands in his sleeves and bowed. The coordinator, a black-bearded Scot, took a deep breath.
You're maybe not going to like this, McTyler, but you've gotten yourself a diplomatic manager. I know these Chinese, and when they get their mind set on something, they're worse than my old woman.
Johnny had lain back. He addressed the ceiling. And what is wrong with my simply asking for my best buckskin suit to be laid out?
Everything, said the coordinator. Just everything.
He sighed and began to explain.
Mr. Tsung is a descendant of a family that served as chamberlains to the Qing Dynasty, those who ruled China from the Mandate 1644 A.D. to about 1911, maybe 1100 years ago. That was the last dynasty before China became a People's Republic. The court and emperors were not Chinese. They were a race called Manchus. And they needed a lot of advice. Tsung says his family served them well, but times changed, and because they had served the Manchus, his ancestors were exiled to Tibet. It was the Western powers that overthrew the Manchus, Tsung says, not his family's advice. So Mr. Tsung here is really a Mandarin of the Blue Button, according to ancestry, a lord of the court. He says all the family records and scrolls are with the Chinese university library you put in a vault someplace.
Russia, said Johnny. They're in the Russian base, though Lord knows how it's holding out right now.
Well, good, said the Scot. He says he could read you some of it, but he doesn't have it here. But his family always kept up on its background, expecting some day a dynasty they could serve would come back into power. They have long memories, these Chinese. Imagine waiting 1100 years to get back a job.
Mr. Tsung detected this was wandering off track, and he nudged the coordinator's arm and made gestures that clearly said, Tell him, tell him. The coordinator sighed. He was not sure how Johnny would take this.
He says you are Lord Johnny, and,
he got it all out in a rush,
you can't go around looking like a barbarian.
If Johnny had not been so worried about other things, he would have laughed. The coordinator was relieved that this had not been received as criticism. He continued.
He says he knew there would be a diplomatic conference, and that a lot of lords would be arriving, and that they would be very uppish and snobbish and fancy. And it's true enough. I've seen them coming in on the platform. Jeweled breathe masks, glittering cloth, ornaments. One even had a jeweled monocle. Pretty fancy dudes.
He then swallowed and said the rest in a rush.
And if you go out there and talk to them in hides, they'll think you're just a barbarian and won't listen to you. He says if you look and act,
he swallowed again,
like an uncouth savage, they'll hold you in contempt.
He stopped, relieved to have gotten through it.
And that's what he was trying to tell you. Don't be upset with him. I could add that quite in addition to a genuine affection for you, about 35,000 lives. No, less than that now. But a lot depend on this conference. Otherwise, I wouldn't have translated it for him, because to me, McTyler, you're no barbarian.
Johnny thought all he would have to do was reassure Mr. Tsung he would be polite and not slap anybody, and that would be that. But not so. Mr. Tsung made the coordinator stand right there and translate everything he said exactly with no changes. Mr. Tsung hunkered down close to the side of the bed and started talking.
the coordinator translated at each pause.
"It is one thing," translated the Scot, "to be a mighty warrior. But although you have won every battle and driven the enemy to rout, from a field of slaughter, the entire war can be lost at the conference table."
Johnny digested that. They actually hadn't won the war yet by a long ways, but even if they did, they could lose the whole thing in that conference room. He had known that, but he was impressed. Mr. Tsung had obviously sought this job not as somebody who cleaned up a room, but as an advisor. Well, heavens knew he needed advice. He had come up with no ideas.
"Your attitude," the coordinator continued to translate as the little Mr. Tsung spoke on, "must be calculated to impress. A lord is used to handling inferiors. He is impressed by being handled as an inferior. Be haughty. Do not be polite. Be cold and disdainful. Be distant and aloof."
"See, this old man is really wringing out my Mandarin. That's real court Chinese he's talking."
Mr. Tsung motioned him not to add his own comments.
"Do not," the Scot obediently translated, "agree or seem to agree to anything. Your words can be tricked into seeming to agree, so avoid the word yes. They will make preposterous demands they know they cannot attain, just to gain bargaining points. So you, in return, should advance to them impossible demands, even if you feel they won't agree. And who knows, you might win them. All diplomacy is a matter of compromise. There is a middle ground between the two opposite poles of impossible demands, which will become the eventual treaty or agreement. Always work for the most advantageous position you can get."
The Scot paused.
"He wants to know if you've got all that."
"Yes, sir," said Johnny, "and welcome." He was feeling this was useful, even though it didn't give him the idea he needed.
"And now," said the coordinator, "he wants to give you a lesson in deportment. Watch him."
Well, they were dealing with creatures from many another race, and their ideas of deportment and those from ancient imperial China might not agree at all. So Johnny felt a bit tolerant as he watched the Chinese. But almost immediately, he felt he was wrong. These manners fitted any race. How to stand, feet apart, tall, leaning slightly back, firmly fixed to the earth, position dominant. Got that? Then do it. How to hold a scepter or wand, one hand on grip end, other end laid in the other palm. Grip both ends to show control. Tap one end into palm to hint the small possibility of punishment when one might wish to seem a bit offended. Wave idly in air to show that the other's argument was of no consequence and was like the wind. Got that? Here is a wand. Do it. Not quite right. Be easy, lordly. Now do them all again. Walk as though not caring what lies before you. Suggest power, steady, unstoppable. Like this. Got it? Do it. For half an hour, Mr. Tsung worked on Johnny. And Johnny realized that his own walk was like that of a panther, whereas for this conference it must be stately. Mr. Tsung made him go through the whole lesson, and then the postures and walks again before he was satisfied. Johnny, who had always had a sinking feeling about being a diplomat, began to feel a bit more confident. There was an art to this thing. It was like hunting game, but a different kind of game. It was like a battle, but a different kind of battle. He thought he was all through. He could see on the screen that more and more emissaries were arriving. But Mr. Tsung said they would all have to present their credentials at the first meeting in the conference room, and that there was lots and lots of time. Had Johnny thought of a strategy? A strategy was very necessary. How to approach the diplomatic battle? What one intended to use to maneuver? Well, Johnny could think about it. It was like a battle, but your infantry and cavalry were ideas and words. Maneuvered wrongly, it meant defeat. Meanwhile, they had to handle this other matter, and leaving Johnny a bit mystified, Mr. Tsung went out in the hall. Seeing that for a moment Johnny wasn't busy, Chief Chong Wan slid in the door. He was beaming and bobbing his head.
"That dam?" He had made a tight grip with both fists and gestured with his hands.
The hole! The outflow is decreasing. The level of the lake is rising.
He bobbed his head vigorously, bowed deeply, and vanished. Johnny thought, well, that was one thing that had gone right. The power wouldn't go off and leave some diplomat parked in some wrong space. All he had to worry about now was a burning planet, the fate of its people, and this conference. That shot had worked. He wasn't dizzy. 6. The other matter turned out to be a haircut. The daughter came in and sat him in a chair facing the view screens and got to work with a small pair of scissors and a comb. The idea was rather novel to Johnny. He usually just hacked his hair off with a knife when it got too long. She seemed to be very practiced and expert, and no doubt took care of the tonsorial requirements of many, for she just sailed in with her scissors moving so fast they sounded like an oar belt running at high speed. Clip, clip, clip. So diplomacy was like a battle, Johnny was thinking. Watching these lords arrive, one could see that they practically oozed authority and power. The visitors attacking Earth were almost local small fry, controlling at the most a few dozen planets. Some of those arriving, he knew from earlier readings, were from other universes and controlled hundreds of planets in just one governmental sphere. And they were very arrogant, very sure of themselves. Whatever their physical form, there was no doubt that they were ministers plenipotentiary to powerful heads of state. What wealth and striking power they represented! Behind them were collective populations numbering trillions in just one state alone. They were the veterans and victors of hundreds of such conferences. Yes, a conference was a battle, and an even more important one than a war. And what chance did he and Sir Robert have against these experienced diplomats? They were both warriors, not glib, smooth, cunning courtiers with 1,000 parliamentary tricks up their sleeves. With no guns or battalions, but with only his wits and the tips Mr. Tsung had given him, he felt quite outnumbered, and so far he had no strategy at all. The girl had a small mirror she was holding up so he could see. She had cut his hair to collar height and back, and combed and rolled it at the bottom. It looked kind of like a helmet he had seen with a back neck guard, and the hair was shiny. His beard and mustache looked very precise, much shorter. He hardly knew himself. Had she seen some old paintings of men with beards and mustaches cut like this? Indeed she had. There was an ancient man book, English, open on the bed to a picture of somebody named Sir Francis Drake that had defeated somebody called the Spaniards long, long ago. His attention was attracted by something, and he took the mirror from her. His neck. The scars had been quite faint, for they were really calluses, and they were gone. He had to look very hard to see the remains of the Brigante grenade scar on his cheek. That would probably vanish, too. Somehow he felt freed with the collar scars gone. He understood the irony of it, and would have smiled, but his attention was pulled to the ops room screen. The sound relay had been off, and he gave the girl back the mirror and hit the button. "Can't think what they're up to," Stormalong was saying, as he angrily finished pulling another picture out of the drone resolver. "I've lost count." 15, said somebody else. "Look at this. A spray of firebombs going down into this deserted..." He looked at the map. "Detroit. Why set Detroit on fire? There's been nobody in Detroit for over 1,000 years. Are they trying to pull defenses over to that continent? They're insane." He threw the picture down. "I'm not providing any air cover for a bunch of ruins. What's the latest from Edinburgh?" "Anti-aircraft still replying," said someone at the ops board. "Smoke interfering with visual firing? Dunnell Dean just shot down his 16th Horven strafing plane?" Johnny touched the button to sound off. He felt an impatience taking hold of him. These diplomats coming in one by one, it was too slow. The coordinator had come in with Mr. Tsung, who was holding a lot of things in his arms. It was obvious that Johnny was under strain. Mr. Tsung said something in his sing-song voice.
The coordinator said, Mr. Tsung reminds you that even a lost battle can be redeemed at a conference table. To be patient and use skill.
Mr. Tsung had other things now. He took the haircut cloth off Johnny and showed him a tunic. It was a very plain garment at first glance. It was cut from shimmering black silk. It had a stand-up collar. It was supposed to be a tight form fit, but it was the silver-colored buttons that attracted Johnny's attention. He knew what they were. He had once remarked to Care that it was surprising to see such pretty metal on a cyclo-emergency switch. It looked like silver at first glance, but the least amount of light striking it made it glow in rainbow colors. Care had said, no, it wasn't used for emergency switches because it was pretty. It was used because it was hard. It was a one-molecule-thick metal spray of an iridium alloy, and no matter how many claw points hit it, it wouldn't wear off. And when you were in a dark mine, with little light, the emergency button was visible because it looked like it flashed in colors. He knew what the son-in-law had been doing, plating buttons, enough to blind you. Mr. Tsung had him put it and the black silk pants on and button the tunic all up. Iridium buttons every couple of inches down the front. Then Mr. Tsung made him put on a pair of boots. They were chinko boots, but they had plated them with iridium alloy. A belt was fastened around him, a wide one, and it was also plated, all except the buckle. And that was his old gold-colored U.S. Air Force buckle, shined until it gleamed. He remembered thinking once, in the cage, he might be the last surviving member of a long-gone force. A strange thing to think, but right now it sort of cheered him up. He had thought he was getting dressed and was a bit dismayed to find that Mr. Tsung did not like a pucker on the shoulder and a certain gather in the tunic back and took it all off him and sent them back. Mr. Tsung had something else now. It was his twisted knob carry with the carved figures, but they had plated it with iridium. It flashed like a length of flame. He knew he couldn't use it that way, but he was glad not to be going into that conference totally without a weapon. Then the son-in-law came in. He was carrying a helmet. Basically, it was just a Russian helmet they had smoothed down. But what had they done to it? The chin strap was plated with iridium alloy. So was the whole helmet. But what was this? The son-in-law turned it, a bit proudly, so Johnny could see what was on the front. How had they done this? Then he saw that the son-in-law was holding the paper patterns he had laid down on the helmet front and sides, one after the other, and sprayed through the open holes with different metal sprays. It was a dragon. And what a dragon! Gold wings on the side of the helmet, clawed paws that seemed to grip the lower helmet edge, scales and spikes from the spine edged in blue, a ferocious face with what appeared to be real rubies for flaming eyes, white fangs and a scarlet mouth. Ferocious. And a round, whitish ball in its scarlet, otherwise gaping mouth. It looked three-dimensional. It was similar to the dragon at the console and the clay dragons lying on the building pile, except for this big white ball in its mouth. At first, Johnny felt it was far too fancy. And just then another emissary arrived on the platform, wearing a towering gold crown. This was far less fancy than that, but still. Johnny looked at it. It was a bit different from the other dragons. Very beautiful, said Johnny, so the coordinator could tell the son-in-law. They were fixing his clothes. It wasn't time yet by a long way. Johnny looked at the helmet. Via the coordinator, he said to Mr. Tsung, Tell me about this dragon. Mr. Tsung tossed it off, and via the coordinator told Johnny that the throne of China had been called the Dragon Throne. Lung Pao, or Chai Fu, patterns or robes were court dress. It was an imperial. Johnny knew all that. Tell him to tell me about this dragon. It's different. Mr. Tsung sighed. There were a lot of other things, far more important, that he should be telling Lord Johnny, and he didn't think it was very applicable just now to embark on myths and fairy tales. But, well, yes, this dragon was different. The whole story? Oh, my. Well, it went this way.
Once upon a time, Johnny lay back on the bed with the helmet on his stomach and listened.
Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 9, Side 2. Johnny lay back on the bed with the helmet on his stomach and listened. Unfortunately, he did have time. So he listened as Mr. Tsung went on telling him the long and involved fairy tale. Suddenly, about halfway through it, Johnny abruptly sat up and said to the coordinator, "I thought so. Please, send for Sir Robert." It startled Mr. Tsung, and Johnny said, "Thank you. Very good story. Thank you more than you know." As Lord Johnny seemed pleased and things were a bit rushed, Mr. Tsung happily went out to make sure the silk suit was altered correctly. Johnny looked around to see whether there were any button cameras in the place. He couldn't really tell. He didn't think so, but he would be very brief and cryptic to play it on the safe side. A couple minutes later, Sir Robert came in. He, too, had been grooming himself. He was wearing a cloak with the Royal Stuart colors, a matching kilt, and Scottish white spats. The wool was made of shining hairs. He was the complete Scottish soldier and lord, excepting only weapons. Johnny had never seen him dressed in full regimentals before. Quite impressive, but the old man looked a bit hollow-eyed and worried. "This is going to be a tough one," said Johnny. "Aye, lad. Did you ken that tall nip? I be no diplomat, laddie, and there's nae chance of bringing Fergus out. The danger lies in antagonizing them lords and states that isna involved as yet. A false step, and we'll be adding them to the enemy." He was upset, even talking in dialect. Johnny never thought he'd have to soothe Sir Robert. "We have a chance, a good one. Now, here's what I propose we do. You go in there by yourself and do all you can." Sir Robert didn't much care for that, but he listened. "And then, when you have finished or think you have gone as far as possible, you call me in. Introduce me however you please, but not too specifically. The communicator they've been using as host will do all the introductions," said Sir Robert. "Well, tell him what I said, all right?" "Verra good, laddie. I'll do whatever I can. And if I havena a ceasefire, I'll call ya." The old war chief turned to leave. "Good luck," said Johnny. "Aye, lad, that's exactly what I'll be needin'. We're nae a-doin' weel at a' in the field." Johnny looked at his watch. It wouldn't be long now. Chief Chong Wan popped in, grinning.
"The hole in the dam has stopped all but a trickle. My men are replacing the armor cable, patching and replacing it. The lake will be armored again before nightfall."
He threw his arms up, simulating the earlier explosion Johnny had made.
"Boom!"
he said, and vanished. Johnny thought, "Boom indeed. We'll all go boom if this conference fails." 7. Sir Robert had not been in the conference room 3 minutes before he realized that he was fighting the most difficult duel of his life. And he was in no shape for it. He had hardly slept at all since their return, and he recognized now that this was a huge error. For all his nickname, the Fox, he felt sluggish mentally. That nickname had been earned in physical combat and not in a conference room. Had this been a matter of troop dispositions and tactics, he could have coped with it. He would have laid an ambush for this Tallnep and transfixed him with arrows and hacked him to pieces with Lochaber axes. But there stood the Tallnep, elegant, poised, and deadly, already pressing Sir Robert back toward defeat. Sir Robert's morale was very bad. Half the anti-aircraft cover of Edinburgh had been wiped out by a desperate charge of Tallnep Marines. Russia was not answering at all, and his own wife was unreported after a cave-in of passages to the bunkers. It was desperate that he get a ceasefire. Yet this Tallnep was dithering around, posing, fiddling with his scepter, flattering the emissaries, and acting like he had all the time in the world. His name was Lord Schleim. He had a tittering laugh that alternated with insidious acid hisses. He was a master of debate, much like a swordsman became a master of his blade.
"And so, my worthy colleagues," the Tallnap was saying now, "I really have not the faintest idea why this assemblage was convened at all. Your own time, your physical comfort, even the dignity of your august persons, representing as you do the most powerful lords of the universes, should not have been assaulted and insulted by an upstart lot of barbarians involved in a petty local dispute. This is a purely local affair, a minor spat. It involves no treaties, and so your presence was well known to be unneeded by this weak band of outlaws and rebels who seek to call themselves a government. I propose that we simply dismiss this gathering and leave it up to the military commanders."
The august body stirred, bored. And they were an august body. Jewels glittered on the breathing masks of some. Brilliant cloth rippled as they moved. Some even wore crowns as tokens of the sovereign power they represented. 29 arbiters of the fates of 16 universes, they were quite conscious of their power. They felt that if they so chose, they could flick this small and unimportant planet into eternity with no more than a careless gesture of a claw or fingertip. They were not really paying too much attention to Lord Schleim, but tittering and whispering to one another, possibly about trivial scandals that had occurred since last they saw one another. They were evidence, physically, of what happens when different genetic lines, moving up from different roots, became sentient. Off to the side sat the small gray man, another man, quite similar to himself, but with a better quality gray suit, had arrived. They were quietly watching Sir Robert. It was very plain they were not going to intervene or help further. Sir Robert loathed courtiers, weak and corrupt and dangerous. That had always been his opinion of this breed. His contempt, he counseled himself, must not show. "Shall we get on with this meeting?" he said. The emissaries stirred. They muttered responses. "Yes, let's complete the formalities. Must have come for something or other. Let's get it over and done with. I've a birthday party waiting for my pet lizard," a remark followed by laughter. They had all shown their credentials earlier, and these had been acknowledged by the group, all but Sir Robert's. Lord Schleim had seated himself off to the side, in front, where he could appear to be addressing them all as their leader.
"We have not actually examined the credentials of this soldier who called this meeting," he offered. "I move that he be removed as the principal speaker, that I be appointed in his stead."
Sir Robert offered them the disc. It was played. It was in Gaelic, a tongue they didn't know. And he might have been called ineligible to conduct the meeting, had he not looked beseechingly at the small gray man, and if one of the disinterested members had not asked the small gray man whether he had accepted these credentials. The small gray man nodded. Bored, the rest of them accepted the credentials. That one had been touch and go for Sir Robert, for just prior to his entrance he had gotten word that the chief of Clan Fergus had been wounded in repelling an attack on the guns, and he did not know whether he could get a confirmation from Edinburgh.
"I fear," said Lord Schleim, "that I must raise another critical point. How can we be sure that this upstart planet can afford even the small costs of convening such a meeting as this? Your lordships surely would not want to remain unpaid and have to bear such expenses yourselves. They guaranteed the diplomatic costs, but we have no way of knowing that they will ever pay them. A scrap of paper saying that one is owed does not fit well in the pocket."
The emissaries laughed at the joke, poor as it was. "We can pay," glowered Sir Robert.
"With scraps of dirty plates?" said Lord Schleim.
The emissaries laughed some more.
"With galactic credits," snapped Sir Robert.
"Taken, no doubt," said Lord Schleim, from the pockets of our crewmen. Well, never mind. Your august lords have a perfect right to declare that the meeting should proceed. But I myself feel it is demeaning for the representatives of such mighty and powerful sovereigns to meet just to determine the conditions of surrender and capitulation of some felons.
Stop! Bellowed Sir Robert. He had had enough. We are not here to discuss our surrender. Also, there are other planets than your own involved, and we have not heard from them.
Ah, said Lord Slime with a leisurely, airy rotation of his scepter. But my planet has the most ships here, two for every one the other planets have. And the senior officer of this combined police force happens to be a Tallnep, Quarter Admiral Snowleater.
Is dead, roared Sir Robert. His flagship, the Capture, is lying right out there in the lake. Your admiral and that entire crew are carrying.
Oh, so? Said Lord Slime. It had slipped my mind. These accidents happen. Space travel is a perilous venture at best. Probably ran out of fuel. But it doesn't alter what I have just said at all. Captain Rogo-Dieter Snowl is the senior officer, then. He has just been promoted. So, it remains that the senior commander and the greatest number of ships are Tallnep, which leaves me in the position of principal negotiator for the surrender of your people and planet after their unprovoked attack on us.
We are not losing, stormed Sir Robert.
Lord Slime shrugged. He cast a negligent glance over the assemblage, as though pleading with them to have patience with this barbarian, and drawled,
Would the assemblage give me leave to confirm certain points?
Yes, of course, they muttered. Reasonable request. Lord Slime's head bent over the round ball atop his scepter, and with a shock Sir Robert realized it was a disguised radio, and that he had been in communication with his forces all along.
Ah, said Lord Slime as he raised his head, showed his fangs in a smile, and fixed his glass-hooded eyes on Sir Robert. 18 of your major cities are in flames.
So that was why they were burning deserted cities, to make an appearance of winning, just to terrorize and have a bargaining position in any surrender talks. Sir Robert was about to tell him those were just deserted ruins that hadn't been lived in for a millennium, but Lord Slime was pressing on.
This august assembly needs proof. Please have this trace run off.
He pulled a tiny thread from the base of the radio, a trace copy of the type they received from drones.
I will not do it, said Sir Robert.
The assemblage looked a little shocked. It began to dawn on them that maybe this planet's forces were losing.
Suppression of evidence, laughed Lord Slime, is a crime punishable by this body by fines. I suggest you mend your attitude. Of course, if you have no modern equipment.
Sir Robert sent the trace out to a resolver. They waited, and presently a stack of pictures came back. They were spectacular air views in full color, of 25 burning cities. The flames were roaring thousands of feet into the air, and if you passed a finger down the right border, the sound turned on. The sound of rushing flames and crashing buildings cut through with a howl of furnace winds. Each picture had been taken at a height best showing the conflagration, and the resulting effect was devastating. Lord Slime passed them around. Paws and jeweled hands and inquisitive feelers made them roar.
We offer, said Lord Slime, very liberal terms. I am quite sure I will be rebuked by a motion of our House of Plunder for being so liberal. But my feelings of pity prompt me, and my word here is, of course, binding upon my government. The terms are that all your population be sold into slavery, to meet the indemnities it occurred when Earth brought on this unprovoked war. I can even guarantee that they will be well treated. Over 50% survive such transportation on the average. Other belligerents, the Hovens, Jambit Chows, Bulbards, Strawkins, and Cairns, to divide up the rest of the planet to meet the expenses incurred in defending themselves against this unprovoked attack upon their peaceful ships. Your king can go into exile on Tallnep and even be provided with a spacious dungeon. Good, fair terms. Too liberal, but my feelings of compassion prompt them.
The other emissaries shrugged. It was obvious, it seemed to them, that they had been called here just to witness some surrender terms in a petty war. Sir Robert was thinking fast, trying to see a way out of this trap. At the start of the meeting, he thought he had heard the hum of the transshipment rig 2 or 3 times. He could not be sure. He could not count on anything right now. He was tired. His king was wounded. His wife might be dead. All he could really think of was leaping on this horrible creature and taking his chances with those poisoned fangs. But he knew such an action before these emissaries would be fatal to their last glimmering chances. Seeing his indecision, Lord Slime said with a harsh, acid hiss,
"You earthlings realize that these mighty lords can make an agreement to force your capitulation? I believe the other combatants of the combined police force agree to my terms."
The representatives of the Hovens, Jambit Chows, Bulbards, Drawkins, and Cairns all nodded and said, one after the other, that they certainly agreed to these liberal terms. The rest of the assembly was just watching, a local dispute. But they could swing over and support the Tallneps if it meant ending this useless consumption of their time.
"I came," said Sir Robert, "to discuss your surrender. But before we go any further with this, I shall have to call in my fully authorized colleague."
He made a signal in the direction of where he knew the button camera was and sat down. He was tired. The slowness and delay of these deliberations had eaten into him. Didn't these gilded popinjays realize that while they dawdled about, good men were dying out there in the field? But urgency never touched them. They were not even really interested. He knew he had failed miserably. He hoped he had not hurt any chances Johnny might have. Forlorn hope. It was all up to Johnny now. But what could the poor lad possibly do? Chapter 27 1 Music began to be heard in the conference room. It was slow, dignified music, ponderous, impressive. The emissaries looked about with some interest, wondering what was going to happen. So far, this had been a deadly dull conference on an apparently deadly dull planet that didn't even have any nightlife or dancing or singing females to serve up. The conference had begun right away, as though there was something urgent or important to take up. Not even a customary round of hotspots to get acquainted. So far, no one had even offered any bribes. Instead, just some boring minor squabble that concerned combatants of just this one universe, and just a sector of it at that. Nice music, fit for regal functions, much less a conference. A huge man entered the door. He was about 6.5 feet tall, stripped to the waist, wearing a scarlet sash, with yellow skin, shaved head. It was one of the Mongols from among the Chinese. That in itself would not have been very interesting, but his muscles were huge and swollen with the effort of carrying something on his head that would seem to be very heavy indeed. But from all they could see, he was carrying nothing. There were his arms and gripping hands. There were his bulging back muscles and biceps. Although he was walking in cadence with the music, there was even a slightly perceptible tremor in his legs. But they could see nothing being carried. The man went up to the platform and with great care set the nothing down. They even heard a bump. It was a glassine electronics table used by Cyclos for small electronic work that required light from every angle. It had been sawed down and sprayed with lens spray that passed light 100%, and so nothing reflected. He arranged the nothing with great care. There was a bit of a flurry in the audience as emissaries craned about and peered, amused and interested. The communicator acting as host,
he had a stripped-down mind radio in his ear, said,
"You have the solemn promise of this planet, at the risk of heavy indemnity, that no lethal, destructive, or harmful object will be entered into this conference room."
Several emissaries laughed. They were quite cheerful. A good joke to put nothing on the platform and then say it was harmless. It quite took their fancy. But something else was happening now. The huge Mongol had withdrawn. To the stately music, two beautifully gowned Chinese boys, faces impassive, came down the aisle. Each was carrying a gorgeous red satin pillow with gold tassels, and on each pillow was a huge book. Solemnly, first one, then the other, approached the host. He took each book from its pillow and laid it upon the heretofore invisible table, spine titles toward the audience. So there was something on the platform. An invisible table. New interest. Those with better eyes could read the titles on the spines up there. One was a dictionary of the Cyclo language. The other was Intergalactic Laws by Treaties of Governing Nations. But Lord Schleim, with his weak tall-nap eyes, was not even trying to read any book titles. He was tense and crouching back. Theatrics. They were pulling theatrics on him. Ah, well. He would corner whoever this was and bite him to death with wick fangs. Sst! On theatrics. They would change nothing. The two boys withdrew in a stately fashion, carrying away their now empty pillows. The music suddenly stopped. There was a roll of drums.
"Masters of all planets, lords of the great and powerful realms of 16 galaxies, may I now introduce to your august presence Lord Johnny, he who embodies the spirit of Earth."
A trumpet fanfare cut through and rose above the drums. The clear, piercing notes rose into the air. Johnny came walking down the aisle. He was walking slowly, heavily, commanding, as though he weighed 1,000 pounds. He was dressed in black and silver, and he carried a silver wand. But it wasn't silver. It looked so, but when the light caught it, on the slightest movement, it flashed with blindingly bright rainbow colors. He came to the platform, stepped up, moved behind the table, and turned. At that instant, a mine spotlight placed just above the door flamed on. He stood there in black and silver, and yet a blaze of living color. He did not speak. Feet apart, not blocked from their view by the table, he held the silver wand between his two hands and simply looked at them with a stern and even disdainful expression. Dominant. This was impressive enough to the emissaries. Even though they were used to pomp and tended to discount it, they would have been respectful of this display. But there was something else. The beast on the helmet, it looked alive. The trick of the light, the play of the silver metal that flashed, the glowing red coals of eyes, whatever it was, it looked alive. Was he wearing a live winged beast on his helmet? Lord Schleim would have none of it. Unfortunately, there had been a slight slip which played directly into his hands. When one word meant several things in Cyclo, it required a slight change of inflection or tone to make it have the different meaning. The word spirit in Cyclo could also mean mind, angel, or devil, and although the communicator had used the right inflection for spirit, Lord Schleim chose to accept a different inflection. The tallnep sprang up as though striking from cover.
"Lords and august emissaries," he said with an acid hiss, "I challenge the right of this devil to speak. We have seen no credentials. We..."
"Sir," said Johnny, "I could not quite hear you. What did you say?" Lord Schleim whirled on him. He began savagely,
"I said..."
"Ah, yes, yes, yes," said Johnny, waving his wand. "I beg your pardon, your lordship. It was merely your uncouth tallnep accent, quite provincial. Can you understand him, my lords?" They laughed. It was true that Schleim had a bit of an accent, due probably to his fangs and having to hiss. Tallneps were really quite rural. They had only one planet, and that was quite distant from the center of things.
You devil, hissed Slime.
Said Johnny. No violence in such a meeting. I am quite certain I, nor the truly worthy emissaries in this gathering, desire your ejection from it. Then, before Slime could retaliate, something else happened. The wand, which had been tapping Johnny's palms, suddenly pointed in the direction of Slime's feet. It had a small beam of light set in the end of it, and it flashed on. It was a light used to show dust in a mine shaft, and it made a very thin white pencil of light, like a pointer. Johnny looked a bit incredulous. Then he turned his head clear off to the side as though to hide a laugh. The light switched off. Slime looked down. He had to stretch, for he had a bit of a paunch. What had this devil seen? Then Lord Slime saw them. His boots. Instead of wearing his proper scaled, glittering green boots, he was wearing old, rough blue boots. Dirty blue boots. His valet. In the rush of getting him off, his clumsy, damned valet had put the wrong boots on him. Oh, when he got home. When he got home, he would have the oaf punctured. Worse, dragged through the streets and bitten to death by small children. But Johnny was addressing the emissaries. I must apologize to you, my lords. I pray you to overlook my discourtesy in arriving late. But I am sure you will understand when I tell you that I was looking for a point of law. He looked at them in a kindly and deferential fashion, laid down the wand on the invisible table, and tapped the top of the law book. The manners and phrases of the old Chinko instruction discs were coming in handy now. At first, when he entered, he had felt stiff and unnatural, artificial and affected. But suddenly, it felt as though he had been doing this sort of thing all his life. No one, he continued, could possibly expect such noble and such highly titled and credentialed lords to experience an uncomfortable trip, nor to convene upon such a lowly and undeserving planet for the petty purpose of adjudicating the minor differences of some back-planet squabble. The delegates sat up. This was more like it. This is what they had been thinking all the time. Hear, hear. Sir Robert was thunderstruck. What was this lad up to? The war not important? Their strong points caving in, their friends dying, and he could say it wasn't important? He looked at the two small gray men. They were both sitting there smiling, a bit vacant, but smiling. They hadn't been smiling before, and Sir Robert knew for a fact that Johnny hadn't talked with them, so they knew no more than he. But he had to restrain himself from jumping up to cry out that this was an important war. One point. These emissaries in their jewels and flashing clothes, strange faces and feelers, were all bobbing their heads and settling down for a real conference. No, continued Johnny, it would be an insult to the mighty states you represent to call you here on something as trivial as repelling pirates. Lord Slime started to slither up out of his chair. He was about to shout this devil down and force him to mend his language when he saw those eyes looking again at his boots. But it wasn't really the glance at the boots that stopped Lord Slime. He recognized, with diplomatic shrewdness, that this devil could fall into a trap of his own digging. It was a very simple matter to prove that the attacking Tolnep ships were fully commissioned legal ships and officers of the Tolnep Navy. So let the devil plow on for now. He'd fang him shortly. Ha! The fellow was no real opponent after all. Such regal representatives of kings and governments, continued Johnny, should, and if I am wrong, please correct me, convene on real points of treaties and intergalactic law. And on these their expertise cannot be seriously challenged or questioned. Hear, hear. True. Naturally. You have a point. Pray continue. The emissaries, all except for the combatants, were sitting up, interested. And all combatant representatives began to look uneasy. All except Lord Slime, who was beginning to feel confident. This devil was going to dig a hole for himself. There was one trouble here for Lord Slime. Each time that devil moved, it made lights flash off his buttons. and Tallnaps had to wear filters to convert to ordinary visible spectrum. So every flash of a button overwhelmed the power of the filter, and he was getting a headache. He wished he could make them turn off that spotlight they had on this creature. Johnny was sweeping on. The definition of the category of pirate, as opposed to the definition of military force, is a critical question. I am sure that from time to time, even in the best organized, paid, and regulated military forces, elements of navies or even merchant ships have mutinied, or gone astray, or been misled, and have turned pirate, defying the benign and responsible authority of their own governments. Oh, yes, many instances. Just last month, in these troubled times, a squadron of spaceships had mutinied at Oxentab. Lots of them in history. An old point, the emissaries agreed. Lot of stories written about it. Go on. So, continued Johnny, to protect legitimate authority, such as that which you represent, pleased faces except for the combatants, and to really be able to cope with piracy when it occurs, the definition must be clarified. And this can only be done by an august body such as yours in the form of a formal treaty. Good idea. Correct. Right. Very glum combatants, except Schleim, who was certain now this devil would shortly be sent down in flames. Johnny opened the Cyclo dictionary to a marked place. We know that the Cyclo language is a composite of many tongues, even your own individual languages, and was not in fact a language generated solely by the Cyclos. It is a universal tongue because it was taken from many universes, which is the only reason we so generally speak it. That was true. Real scholarship. The Cyclos picked up everything from others, including language. Shouldn't even be called Cyclo. The emissaries buzzed about it. This dictionary, said Johnny, is the standard recognized work, is it not? He held it up. Yes, they nodded. Johnny laid the book down and read from it. It states, pirate, one who preys upon commerce or communities or planets in a vessel or spaceship or group of ships not under the regulation of a national or planetary government. Also, any commander or crew member of such a ship. Right, right, that was a pirate. But Lord Schleim was feeling very smug. He felt he really had this devil now. He could see exactly which way he was trying to go. It would be child's play to fang these arguments to pieces and then proceed with the surrender talks. What a letdown the devil was going to get. Every Tallnap ship was under the direct orders of the Tallnap government. Totally legal. Johnny had turned to the book on intergalactic law. However, according to treaties of which intergalactic law is composed, we have a different definition. With your permission, I will read it. Article 234,352,678. Based on the treaties of Cyclo versus Hoven, signed at Blanc, Cyclo versus Kamchad, signed at Cyclo, a pirate shall hereinafter be defined as one who feloniously steals or mines minerals. Johnny tapped the book and laughed lightly. I guess we know who and how and why that misdefinition occurred. They laughed. Cyclo was not very well liked, and a Cyclo would pass anything to protect Cyclo interests. Therefore, said Johnny, this august body, I feel, should define pirate and piracy among systems and planets, and, after due deliberation, envisage the execution of treaties to forbid it. Sir Robert groaned. The lad was proposing days of wrangling over stale things like treaties when the planet was being torn to bits with a flat-out assault, undoubtedly egged on by this Tallnap through his hidden radio. But his groans were drowned in the general assent. Johnny had now drawn back from the books. He took up the wand. He tapped it in his palm. I feel, in my humble opinion, he certainly didn't look humble, that we must work upon this now in order that we should know whether the Tallnap fleet officers and crewmen are to be slowly vaporized individually as pirates or simply shot as military men when court-martialed. Lord Schleim slithered up with a scream. Stop! He glared around at the other combatants. They just sat behind him. They were saying nothing. They simply looked stunned. Then he realized that the devil had said Tallnep. He had not said combined forces. Venom splattered as Lord Slime hissed his protest. The devil had gone too far. In a moment, Lord Slime would tear down his house, but just now there was another point.
You are selecting out the Honorable Tallnep forces for your venomous insinuations, said Slime ravingly. This is a clear case of prejudice and has to be dismissed as such by this body. There are other combatants. I demand these statements to be stricken from our recorders as biased, slanted, and an intentional insult to the Tallnep planetary forces.
Johnny calmly smiled at him and looked at the Tallnep boots and back up to the fanged face. Bombastic conduct will right no wrongs here. Your conduct insults these lords. Behave yourself.
I demand a reply, screamed Slime.
Johnny sighed tolerantly. Very well, you shall have it. It is my opinion that the Hovens, Bulbods, Drawkins, Jambit Chow, and Hockner forces were simply coerced, probably with false statements, into cooperating with the Tallneps. Since by your own testimony your ships vastly outnumber theirs, and since your own senior officer, as you state, commanded the so-called combined force, and when killed was succeeded by another Tallnep, who is now their senior officer, it seems very evident they were forced to cooperate in this attack by the superior firepower of the Tallnep fleet. So we cannot hold these other races or forces guilty, and we are not charging them. They are only victims, and cannot be regarded, in my opinion, in any other way when we apply the word pirate on a clarified definition. Now was the time. Lord Slime knew the ripe moment when he saw it. He would crush this devil. He slithered himself up to his full height. He assumed the grandeur of dignity.
Your arguments, devil, drop into the rocks and fall like dust into the grass. The Tallnep Admiral and the Tallnep Captain and all the Tallnep ships and crews were never in any way acting outside the command of the Tallnep Central Government. So, enough of this claptrap about pirates, and let us get on with the proper business of surrender.
The taste of triumph and victory was sweet as poison in the Tallnep's mouth. In a few moments now, this whole thing would be finished. Sir Robert groaned. He saw the two small gray men were looking down, nervous now, regretting perhaps they had helped. 2. Johnny looked at the Tallnep. He shook his head sadly. He looked at the assemblage. They were leaning back, beginning to lose interest. For a while there, it had appeared that something would occur that would concern them. My lords, said Johnny, please do forgive this distraction from the main purpose of this meeting. This Tallnep is absolutely demanding that we finish this minor concern of a raid upon a peaceful planet. So, with your permission, I feel I have no other choice than to settle this slight disturbance. Yes, so well, go ahead. One doesn't see where this is going now, but go ahead. I suppose the Tallnep will just keep interrupting, so go ahead. Johnny sighed. Thank you, your lordships. You are very tolerant. Then he turned to Lord Slime. Johnny took a very firm stand with his feet. He had picked up the wand and was now tapping it in his palm. Lord Slime, said Johnny, for I believe that is what some call you, please produce the orders given to your admirals and captains. Slime laughed.
You know very well an emissary cannot carry with him the whole files of a military establishment. Furthermore, although you, as a barbarian, would have no inkling of this, a Tallnep commander is at liberty to exercise autonomy on military expeditions.
As I suspected, said Johnny. There were no legal orders.
I did not say that,
hissed Slime. I'm afraid you did, said Johnny. I have no choice now but to proceed, for you are delaying more important proceedings. Johnny smacked the wand into his palm twice. It sounded like two pistol shots. There was an instant rush down the aisle as two uniformed technicians came, pushing a mine cart. The cart had been plated in gold. It looked very sleek. On it rested a projector of some size, and it too was gold-plated. It was an atmosphere screen projector. Its general use was to project pictures of mine shafts or tunnels. It used a projection light based on the same principle as an atmosphere armor cable, with a variation. The light, striking atmosphere ions, made them condense to greater or lesser degree and reflect back. By putting a stick for scale in the original scene, one could then take the projected picture and actually measure distances in it from point to point. It put, in this way, a three-dimensional picture on thin air. The technicians moved it into a place where it would project into the large, empty space to Johnny's left. They placed a multiple-button switch on the invisible table close to Johnny's hand. They bowed, about-faced, and withdrew. They had come in so fast and left so quickly that Lord Schleim had not had time to get in an objection. Now he did.
"I must protest this display of foolish flimflam. I will not permit you to hoodwink this august body further."
"Schleim," said Johnny severely, "it will do no good for you to seek to suppress evidence when you well know it will work to your disfavor." Mutters from the emissaries.
"Sit down, Schleim. Be quiet. This looks like it will be interesting." "Hush, Schleim."
Johnny pressed two buttons. The spotlight at the door went out, and simultaneously a picture flashed on it. It was a three-dimensional, remarkably detailed close-up of Ruf Arsabager. He seemed to the emissaries to be standing right there in what had been empty space. There was no sound. But they had never before seen a mine atmosphere projector, for the simple reason that the Cyclos never marketed entertainment gadgets, and this was mining equipment. Ruf Arsabager's face was patched with the sores of disease. His fangs were black, and one was broken. He was dressed in something that looked like it had been discarded from a slum. It was part of a long series of pictures shot by pilots flying air cover at the Purgatoire River. It had been taken with a radio telephoto camera. The shots had been left in Johnny's room to help do the briefing of the time he had been out of action. Johnny said, "Is this man a member of your government? Now answer carefully, Schleim. Is this a minister of any department, an official of the military?" Several emissaries tittered. The figure was so disgusting that if this were a member of the Talnap government, well... Schleim was stung. He looked at the picture. What a disgusting creature. Vomitous. Eyes still dazzling a little bit from the lights flashing off the devil, he pawed at his filter and stared again. Was there something vaguely familiar about that figure? That he was peering so hard made it seem that maybe the Talnep government was composed of such riffraff. Several emissaries laughed out loud. That did it. Schleim lashed out,
"Of course not. That filthy creature would be thrown out of any government department on Talnep. You are insulting me. You are insulting Talnep. You are running a calculated campaign to degrade the dignity and importance of my office and my planet. I must protest."
"Quiet," said Johnny soothingly. "Just pay attention here. You have said he is no part of your government and has no official capacity. Is that right?"
"Absolutely. If you think..."
"Then," said Johnny, "what is he doing giving orders to Quarter Admiral Snowleader?" He pressed another button. The camera seemed to draw away. Motion occurred in the scene. The bridge of the capture came into view, along with the diamond with the slash, the Talnep insignia. And there was Quarter Admiral Snowleader facing the horrible creature Ruf Arsabager. Johnny touched another button. Sound came on. This book is continued on Cassette 10, Side 1.